name three more Sorkin-y names. I'll wait.
Everybody, you're Sorkin in it. It's Studio 60. Please take just a minute. It's about a show, kind of like SNL, but it only lasted one season. Oh well, we're Sorkin in it.
Welcome back to Sorkin in it. It's a new week, a new show, and your same old favorite hosts. He's Lex Friedman.
I am, and he's Brian Warren.
Yes. All right. Well, we're here. My gosh, we did like 10 movies in a row, all written by Aaron Sorkin. And then we did a whole three seasons of The Newsroom. But now it's time for a new show. And I imagine everybody listening to this has already clicked on it in their podcast player of choice. So they know we're doing Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
Unbelievable. You and I have talked about this a bit. We both watched it when it originally aired.
Yeah.
I believe I have watched it one other time since. And I don't know. I was excited to press play on the pilot. How did you feel when you were going in? Were you optimistic, pessimistic?
I mean, you know, we both shared some optimism in our little intro episode last week. And but from the moment I clicked play, I was like, yep, I have not seen this one since I first watched it air. Like, so much of this was pretty unfamiliar. So it was kind of like watching it all over again for the first time.
I definitely don't know this intimately, especially when it's this few episodes. Like, you don't really get to know everything so much.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot that I remembered and a lot that I forgot. But I don't know. I'm just going to tell you, I thought this was great. I really liked it.
You know, I did too. Part of it's I love a lot of these cast members so much. And so part of it was just this kind of warm, cozy feeling of seeing people like Timothy Busfield again. But I don't know. They walked us along for the ride. There were things that kind of made me feel a little icky, but for the most part, and especially by the end of it with that wrap up speech, we'll get to it. It was nice. I was like, this is going to be a fun next 22 episodes.
I had a couple complaints, but overall I felt they were minor. I don't know yet what you thought was icky, but I can't wait to find out.
Okay.
And I really liked it. I actually never read the IMDb trivia until just before we pressed record.
And I have yet to read it.
One of those IMDb trivia points is that Bradley Whitford was still filming the last couple episodes of The West Wing while they were starting this show.
Oh, wow.
And that's why he's not in two of the last three episodes of The West Wing, because they were simultaneous. But that they worked really hard to make sure that his character, Danny Tripp, was, you know, didn't have the same mannerisms and personality as Josh Lyman on The West Wing. I did not notice that distinct difference. I thought they felt similar, not in a bad way, but I thought it was like, hey, that's that guy again in a different context. Like, different, but not very different.
The overlap felt like this is Bradley Whitford, you know, being Bradley Whitford.
Exactly. So,
I was fine with it. As characters, they're quite distinct from each other, so it's fine.
I thought this pilot did a great job of setting the stage for the audience with D.L. Hughley at the top. And that weird announcer dude who seems to be on every Sorkin show, but his only credits are Sorkin movies and shows. He plays Herb on Sports Night. Yeah.
He ran the control room, right? Was his name Herb there too?
Clearly that guy has a history with Sorkin. I don't know what it is. But I liked the what our cold open was basically of D.L. Hughley explaining to the in-studio Studio 60 audience what the show is all about. And I mean, it is clearly very much an SNL. It's exactly the same. And then I really thought that Judd Hirsch was a joy to watch as he fought with standards and practices as Wesley. Mm-hmm. I think his name was Wesley. And I couldn't quite tell. I don't exactly feel like he's supposed to be Lorne Michaels, because Lorne Michaels is too put together, but he is their equivalent of Lorne Michaels, but he's not a caricature. He's not a parody of Lorne Michaels. He is a different kind of person.
It was tricky because they kind of refer to him as a writer, but he's kind of also running the show. So
yeah, he's the executive producer, for sure, like the head.
I never think of Lorne Michaels as being someone who writes any of the sketches we see on Saturday Night Live.
Even though he's listed as a writer in the credits, we all know he's not doing that. But I just thought that from the beginning, we had some really nice world building. And like you, hey, there's Timothy Busfield, and I felt nothing but joy. It's a strong pilot, Brian. I'm just going to be praising a lot of things. But so they're talking about how they've got to cut a sketch. He doesn't want to cut the sketch. And what do you want me to fill it with if I do cut it? And we're going to do Peripheral Vision Man. And like, Peripheral Vision Man sounds like a great, not funny sketch. And I thought it worked right away. And I really like when they tell him Timothy Busfield in the control room right before we're going to go live. Hey, we're cutting the good sketch that everybody likes. We're going to do Peripheral Vision Man. And he's like, well, how long is Peripheral Vision Man? And it's shorter. And he's like, oh, so we'll have to stretch it. And his quote is, I'm sure that making it longer was the missing ingredient in making it funny. And I thought that was so good. Like, can you even imagine? Yep. I also thought that this set was epic. Like, this is such a sprawling set for their fake show. Man, I loved it.
They did a great job of making everything feel really lived in and that these people had a history. Even that line about Peripheral Vision Man, it's like they've tried it plenty of times before. And you can just imagine all the history that leads up to a line like that, that makes it feel like these people,
this has been going on for a while,
together for quite some time. And that makes me feel good.
Yeah. The host of the show within a show this week is Felicity Huffman, also from Sports Night.
Mm-hmm.
And she's complaining to Judd Hirsch that she doesn't think the monologue's that funny, and they were supposed to rewrite it, but he's like, yeah, we never did. He's distracted because he's just lost this fight, I guess, with standards and practices. And he gives her the comforting advice of, your instincts aren't wrong. It's not funny. I love that that's what she's being told seconds before she goes out there. I actually really liked the idea that sometimes, and of course it makes sense, and I think I even intellectually knew this before watching this episode, but like, if you think about SNL, like, they sometimes know this is a bad sketch. Like, we've got a bad show tonight. We've got a bad sketch. Like, this isn't going to be funny. And like, knowing that you're going live because you had the week and now it's time, like, yeah, it's not good. Like, that's, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. If it was all buttoned up, everything was put together, it would feel more fake.
Yeah. I would say that our pal Nate Cordry does not do a great George W. Bush.
No, I wrote that down too. This is not funny.
And I appreciated that when Judd Hirsch is going to walk out and have his mad as hell moment, that he tells them to clear the stage so that everyone knows it's just him. I thought that there was a little hand holding for us as the audience when, like, in the booth, they're like, when did they put this in? What has happened? This is surprising. This is a late edition. Like, clearly this is not scripted. Clearly this, like, they took way too long to understand that this was really happening. That, in Timothy Busfield's words, this is real.
Yeah. There's a bit of physical acting that Michael Stuhlbarg does that's just so good of him. He's kind of leaning back in his chair, and then when he realizes something bad's happening, he spends like a little bit too long trying to get out of that chair because he's got like the script on his lap and stuff, and he's like kind of scrambling to get up and stuff. I rewound and watched it again because it was just so dang funny. And that was a moment of delight.
Did you know that actor from other things?
Yeah.
Michael Stuhlbarg? What do you know him from?
What has he been? He's been in some Coen Brothers stuff. Mm. Gosh, what else has he been
in? I saw him on The Staircase, but used him by name. He plays the standards and practices guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Jerry.
Yep.
And then you get this monologue that Judd Hirsch is doing. He talks about how bad television is, how bad the show is going to be, how you should change the channel or just turn it off. And one of his examples of how bad television is, did it stick with you the way it stuck with me? A game show where people see how much they can be like Donald Trump. And I was like, oh man, if only you knew. If only you knew. But it made me really sad. It was a low point for me in watching the episode. And of course they used the show credits as the show credits. And that's classic Sorkin, a common beat on Sports Night as well. And I thought it's not a bad theme song. I did not have the hatred for it that I had for the Newsroom theme song.
No.
I don't remember what it sounds like, but I recall not hating it.
It had a like saxophone and stuff. And so that made me just instantly snap to thinking of SNL. And so I was like, well, we know who they're trying to go for with this. And it's fine.
The saxophone was, you're right, directly reminiscent of SNL. And it had a lot of sax appeal.
The moment of them trying to figure out when to cut off Judd Hirsch, Wes, was great. It you could feel the tension winding up, and the camera kind of starts zooming in on his mouth, and you can tell that Cal, Timothy Busfield, is waiting for him to almost drop an F-bomb or something. And I think he starts to say mother, and he's like, that's it.
Yes,
that was perfect. I no notes on that.
Yeah, and I think that like they're showing you that it's a big deal in the control room, like you've got a family, whatever, and they spend more in the episode telling you how big a deal it was. Like later in the episode, Cal's going to be like, people get not just fired, but like basically blacklisted for, you know, not cutting it off sooner. We've trained for this. I agree with you. No notes. And at first I was like, wait, is this so after the credits, we get a big, in the same font as The West Wing, we get a big Jordan. And I'm like, is this episode called Jordan? No, but it's this, we're in the Jordan section. And I was like, wow, this is helping drive home how important he believes Amanda Peet is for this show, because she's the first named segment. I did think it was funny that the font was the West Wing font. Like, this is as important as that. Are you a big 3-6 Mafia fan?
No. I wouldn't have been able to pick out any of their songs. No. How about you?
The same. And I thought it was like also a good SNL comparison, because half the time I have no idea who the bands are on that show either. I liked the bong in their room, like when they go into that room to meet, it's filled with smoke, and they're like, somebody get these bongs and loose joints out of here. And Jordan says, I'll take the loose joints. I love her confidence from the very beginning. She is an awesome character. She is maybe the strongest Sorkin woman I've seen in some time. Like, I thought even stronger than like a CJ. Like, she is just full of confidence. I loved the backstage stuff. Like, we see for just a second, you see a couple of folks who are going to be regulars on the show. They're like naked backstage getting ready to go on for some sketch. SNL has an ongoing shtick where whenever you see the backstage area, there's always like a guy dressed as Abraham Lincoln, and there's always like an animal. And I liked it. Like, yeah, there's always chaos going on backstage. I like that a lot. And she doesn't even watch the tape. So when Stephen Weber's going to watch the tape, she's like, I'm going to go see Judd Hirsch. Which, honestly, if I had to pick, I'd go see Judd Hirsch, too. I'd go see the live Judd Hirsch. And she says, I'm sorry about all this, which just makes me like her more, which is exactly what it's supposed to do, but it works.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's totally working. There's one line where they're mentioning Jordan. I can't remember if she's... Oh, it's at that dinner, like that fancy dinner that they're having.
Yes.
And introducing her. And they mentioned that she's the reason that Leno won the late night wars. And that made me like Jordan less. So I was a little bit, but you know, that's all just scripting and stuff. But
yes.
That's the only note I have against her so far.
And I love the Sorkin-ness of it's her first day on the job and this chaos is happening.
Yep.
It's interesting to me that the show kept going. It's interesting that not NBC, but that whatever the fake network is, doesn't just pull the plug on the episode entirely when it's live and they don't know what else is going to happen. And now they're running, in theory, without an executive producer. Like, something really bad just happened on our air. Keep going with your live show. That part is the only part that I would say beggared belief for me in this episode, Brian, if you will.
I will. I definitely will.
Beggared belief.
And we got our first mention of the big three. And I believe that at some point, one of the executives gets confused, which I thought was really dumb. He gets confused about what the big three are. What does he think they're talking about?
They're the automakers in Michigan.
Detroit. What does Detroit have to do with this? Yes, what a great confusion to have. But the big three are Harriet Hayes, Simon Stiles, and Tom Jeter. Name three more Sorkin-y names. I'll wait. Two of them are alliterative.
Yep, pretty good. Tom Jeter is probably the one that sticks out there, but yeah, I could see someone like that being a staffer in the White House.
Yes. Somebody has a line, we're dramatically underreacting. I don't know. And Jordan's making this argument like they're going to see he was right. And as is classic on Sorkin, somebody says, what? Nobody ever hears each other on these shows. And she says, yeah, they're going to say he was right. I love that. Like, her point is like, you guys are all panicking about this, but the point is our TV does suck. And then another, like, because she is a strong, powerful woman, Jordan, she says, let's go talk in my office. And then, of course, I don't know where my office is. And it is funny.
That was pretty good. Yeah. How do you feel about Steven Weber's positioning here? Like, he's kind of supposed to be the, I guess, Leona or the Reese, you know, here, where he's supposed to be evil. But he's not like super evil, but he also kind of feels like she's setting herself up to fall on her face.
Yeah.
But he's kind of also, I don't know. He's not being like a total jerk to her though.
Right. He's not. But I just don't like the way you have to make her feel like this exuding confidence woman. And she's like, I also don't know where my office is. Like, it just felt like it was like a little bit weak, but it was also funny. It worked. I wasn't mad at it. I was just like, come on. That's what I was like. I was like, come on.
Then we move to Matt and Danny, and they're at the awards show, and Matt is stoned. This was probably my first icky part, where I just was, and he just was so out and open about how, yep, I'm on Percocet and all these other things, and it just, I don't know, maybe just because we're so close, it still feels like we're still so close to Matthew Perry's death that just made me ache a little bit on the inside. How about you?
I remembered you saying that there was drug use. And I was even surprised by what we learn over the course of the episode is that it's Bradley Whitford's character, Danny, who's the one who has a drug problem. Mm-hmm. It did not make me feel icky because Matt was in such a good mood about it. It took me also the entire episode to realize that Matt Albee's name was the same as Matt Perry's name. That he's the same for his name. Mm-hmm. But it didn't bother me just because he was happy about it and so self-aware. Like he clearly didn't have a problem. He was just on all these pills and mixing and matching and maybe having, like, I don't know. I understand why it made you feel icky. But I don't know. There was something about it that I thought that Matthew Perry did a great job with it. Now that you could choose to, you know, but like he was locked in and it was really, I don't know. It was so funny.
His acting in this episode is fantastic. I'm going to enjoy watching him on the screen for all 22 episodes, I presume. Expertly done for sure. I loved the Star Spangled Banner breakup conversation too, the way story with the whole preamble. And then by the end of it, he says, and that's not why we broke up. And then we move to some other part of the conversation. That felt so Sorkin, so dialed in.
I agree. And I really, really like what he believes or what he's telling people he got in trouble for. Because she says she got a standing ovation. And he says it's the national anthem they were standing already. That is so funny to me. This is the first time I wrote down Bradley Whitford is forever Josh Lyman to me. And here's why I'll say that. And I this is not a critique because I love Josh Lyman. So I'm happy to see like a different version of him here. His character in whichever dumb Adam Sandler movie he's in, and I like that movie, so I don't mean dumb as a pejorative.
Oh, Billy Madison?
Billy Madison? That's a different character. That does not feel like Josh Lyman. But this one does. It's okay. I also think it's A-plus comedy that Bradley's name is Danny in the show. Like, he's already named one of his characters on Sportsnet, one of the hosts is Danny, and then obviously Timothy Busfield played Danny on The West Wing, so I just loved it. Like, we got to have a Danny. Mm-hmm. And there's a... He's never not been there for me is a nice, powerful line that he's, I like the Danny and Matt friendship. And again, like you talked about with, it feels like there's a lot of history with this show and there's a lot of time. Like you feel their relationship. Like these guys know each other. These guys have come up together and I like that too.
Well, and then the camera pans to the table and he's not there, which is extra funny too. I'm all for it.
And also very Sorkin-y. And now we get, the big three, Chiron. Now we're going to meet the big three. And I think we've talked a little bit about some of this backstory in our preview episode, but Harriet Hayes is, I don't know if I would say largely or loosely based, maybe both, on Sorkin's relationship with Kristen Chenoweth, whom he dated before she was ever on The West Wing, and she was on The West Wing after he left The West Wing. But she went on Pat Robertson's show, and I believe that was the reason that Sorkin broke up with her. And so I think he's relitigating the breakup here on this TV show. I don't know. I thought it was interesting. I think right away I started having flashbacks to my first times watching this series. Harriet Hayes is a character that I feel like sometimes gets, and again, I'm one episode in, I could be wrong, but gets a little bit of the CJ treatment. And CJ is an awesome character and Allison Janney is an awesome actress. I like the character of Harriet Hayes, but they don't do her favors. And Sarah Paulson is obviously another incredible actress, but they don't do the character favors when they talk about how majestic she is instead of just letting her be a real human. And I feel it pretty early on, but I do like, she has a great line early on when she's talking about Matt and she says, I'm a big fan of his and I hate his breathing guts. I like breathing as an adjective in that context. I liked it all. I did think that her final line of the scene was a little bit on the nose when she says, I'll be saying a prayer for you. Like, okay, we already got that she's religious.
Yeah. Yeah. I can sympathize with where you're coming from there. Those are moments of telling, not showing. And I don't think it's necessary.
And then I get to a moment that I don't think is icky, but I just don't like. I love when she says to Simon Stiles, E.L. Hughley, she says, please let me watch you smoke a cigarette. Like, I don't need a cigarette break, but I need an excuse to get out. So you go smoke. Mm-hmm. But then we meet Dylan Killington, who's played by Nate Torrance, who seems like he might be like a Chris Farley-esque member of the cast to a degree. Mm-hmm. And he's like, Harriet, you pray before every show. What happened tonight? Did it just not work? That guy sucks. Like, at least in this episode, he sucks.
Yeah, He sucks.
And it makes no sense. He is, and she's, and this is the time when I stop liking Harry for several minutes in the show, but he is clearly a new cast member, a first year cast member, a rook. And he, I don't care how drunk he is. You don't make jokes at the expense of the star. And that's what he's doing. Mm-hmm. It seems so dumb. And she says to him, well, you had two lines tonight and you stepped on one of them. Until you accept Jesus Christ as your personal savior or make somebody laugh, why don't you talk to somebody else? I think that's mean. I think it's unnecessarily mean. I think she could have just let him embarrass himself and not been cruel. And you can't step on your own line. You stepped on somebody else's line. So you had two lines tonight and you stepped on one of them. Doesn't really make sense to me. You had two lines tonight and you rushed one of them. You had two lines tonight and you stepped on someone else's. I'm just saying I object to her criticism of him. But she's mean. She's mean in that moment.
Yep, yep.
He deserves it maybe, but I want her to be above it.
She could have taken the high road for sure. And that probably feels a little bit more like her. Although, I mean, she's frazzled. She's a human being. Okay. But I don't think that they really connected the dots there.
Yeah. When people ask her if she was offended about this Christianity sketch that was cut, do you remember what her line was? It's pretty good.
No.
I was offended. I wasn't in the sketch.
Yep. That's a good line.
It's good. And it feels very SNL-esque. Like everybody always just wants the airtime, which I totally
after I've already forgotten the guy's name. The Chris Farley style
Dylan.
Rookie kid.
I don't even overhear his name in this episode, but I looked it up on IMDb.
After they had their interchange, didn't one of the other big three, was it Tom Jeter, kind of cut him down a little bit and say, just like, don't, you don't get to do that.
I think it's Simon. He's like, don't do that. Don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so then everybody's getting called back to the studio and Harriet says, this is it. And I was left wondering, what the hell is she talking about? This is what does she say? Like, and it doesn't ever really get paid off. Like, this is it. Like, we're all getting fired. He's been fired. Obviously he's been fired. We already know he's been fired. It's not a surprise to anybody. But I wrote at this point, I am loving this episode overall, but the Studio 60 studio from the outside looks very fake to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like a nightclub or something from the 50s.
Yeah. And I think I actually just read right before we started recording that it is in fact another building that they've added a fake story to or something. It is actually the Palladium with a second story digitally inserted. I did not. Yeah, it doesn't work for me. My chief complaint about this episode is that once again in a pilot, we have a big old coinky dink driving a key plot point. And I just feel like I think of Aaron Sorkin as being better than this. He's not. He's great. I can't take it away from him. But he's totally happy to rely on it. Like, that's the story he wrote the show about. It has a coincidence that Jordan knows about Danny's inability to get insurance because she knows that Danny has relapsed with his drug addiction and thus won't be able to get insurance, so they can't film the movie. So Matt and Danny are going to be available to come back and run the show. And she only knows that because, like, a person she's dating told her or something. I don't know.
That doesn't feel really necessary as a key plot point. I feel like, now, was he considering taking the Studio 60 job anyway, or did he feel like he was cornered into it?
I think the latter.
Because I feel like he kind of believed it was a good idea anyway, but perhaps he was like, well, I'm not going to be able to work for the next couple of years anyway.
Yeah, I think that he saw some of the appeal, but like was all, yeah, I mean, you're right. He knows that he can't get the insurance. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a good question.
The frustrating thing about the Quinky Dink, my gosh, we're saying this a lot, is that
it's a new song.
The belief would be that these two guys wouldn't be able to come in and save Studio 60 if it wasn't for Danny relapsing and Jordan knowing about it. And that kind of like that forcing function feels less exciting to me rather than someone trying to win those two guys over to make them come back and want to do it as opposed to feeling forced to.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's but I do love, like I said, I love the friendship between those two guys, because as soon as, you know, once Bradley Whitford admits to Matthew Perry, hey, I can't do this, I relapsed, you know, or I think even maybe before he said, we can't get the insurance, and he's like, I'll bond you, or we can film in Vancouver, and Danny Bradley Whitford says, Vancouver doesn't look like anything. It doesn't even look like Vancouver. It looks like Boston, California. I love three punches on Vancouver in a row.
Poor Vancouver. It's a very nice town.
Yeah, it really is. Boston, California is very funny, and it doesn't even look like Vancouver. Very funny. You know, they say, you know, they storm out. They don't like that it's being used against them. Steven Weber's like, now I see how you had your secret knowledge, Jordan, whatever. But I like that you know, Matt Albee comes back and he's like, we're gonna do it. Have your people send my people stuff. I like that he's already saying yes before he's seen a contract. Like, we haven't talked about what am I getting paid? Like, what does this contract mm-hmm. look like? How many years is it? You know, yes, it's just sent over the paperwork. It'll be good. Like, okay. It's a behind the scenes Hollywood show, except we're going to totally gloss over probably the most important thing to everybody in Hollywood.
Sure. Fine.
I really did like some of the stuff when he's talking about how bad their shows are, how bad the network is. And she's like, we got embarrassed tonight. And he's like, no, you didn't get embarrassed. Like, the most embarrassing thing is everything on the network, like your dual masturbation show or whatever. And then Jordan's like, I actually have a dual masturbation show in the works. Did you find that the PA was giving you major Maggie vibes?
The PA, I did not catch Maggie at all from that. No.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I liked the PA though. I think she's great. Too. I hope we get to see more of her.
Do you remember the she's character's funny. Name?
Oh, you know what? I remember looking it up when I was watching it, but I couldn't.
She's not Daphne, is she? Because I think I would have recognized Jemma Mays, who I don't even remember being in this episode.
It's Suzanne. Is that right?
I'll believe anything you say. You can just make it up.
Yep. Merritt Weaver.
So you did not get Maggie vibes from Merritt mm-hmm. Weaver as Suzanne.
But now I'll watch it again, and I'm sure I will next week.
And I also, I'm confident I recognize her from stuff. Oh, now I'm seeing all the things I know her from. She's 100% in Michael Clayton. She's 100% in Marriage Story. I thought that she was written as early pilot Maggie, like nervous mm-hmm. and flustered, but like so into it all. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a criticism, just an observation. Okay. Now I said I had one big criticism of the episode. I have two.
Okay.
They have the Pat Robertson fight. We've got Harriet Hayes and we've got Matt Albee hashing it out. You put on a dress and you sang for a bigot. And she's like, well, I sang it for his audience, and his audience is different. He says, throw in the Halloween costumes, you got yourself a Klan rally, which is not a powerful line to me.
Nope.
Because it's not Halloween costumes. It's like Klan outfits and like whatever. But what does Harriet do?
She slaps him. Lex. I remember I watched that and I thought,
Lex won't like that.
Yep, Lex isn't going to like that.
I just don't feel like people hit each other all the time. Am I crazy? No. Am I living a sheltered life?
It could be. How many times have you been slapped in your life?
Listen, my parents were big believers in corporal punishment. Excluding my parents, I think never. I think I have never been slapped.
Yeah, I've never been slapped. Yeah, I don't think I have either. And I've certainly made people grumpy in my life.
it feels so weird to me. And I didn't like it. But mm-hmm. I you see that. She's like even trying to say, hey, can we just get over this? Like, can we put this fight behind us and stop being breathless? And he's like, no, but score for us on Friday nights and we won't have a problem. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking to myself, hey, an X is starring on and running the show. A pair of X's is starring on and running the show. This feels familiar, but the genders are reversed from the newsroom.
yep. And it came, 5 years earlier? So. Yeah.
I don't mind it. Totally but it's different. Just, it's funny that it's the same. Mm-hmm. I thought that Bradley Whitford did a nice job with his addiction stuff. I think they're sitting in a half a taxi cab set mm-hmm. or something. He's like, I had 11 years. Now I have 8 days. And I was like, yeah, you done goofed, bro. And it was at this point that I noticed that Matthew Perry was playing a guy named Matt. I also thought that Matthew Perry's hair was bad in this episode. I thought it was overly gelled. That was my note.
When I see that kind of stuff, I'm like, how long ago was 2007, 2008? Yeah. I was like, did people gel a lot more back then?
Yeah. And then those two clowns who they don't like, Rick and Ron, they want to fire them. Mm-hmm. But they're getting paid $30,000 an episode for several years. So you got to keep the two clowns.
That's almost as much as we get paid for this episode.
Yeah. Now, it sounds like they're paying them $30,000 combined. And I feel like the show could just eat it if they want to get rid of those writers. So I would have just cut them. But they don't. And that's going
to
be a big
trouble. How much did Denver just eat to fire Russell Wilson?
It turns out, Brian, that the cut sketch, this crazy Christian sketch, was written by our friend Matt Albee years ago for the show. Weird that suddenly they called it up. And then Jordan gets this powerful moment because she tells Matt and Danny, open with it next week. Now, not every sketch can be a cold open, Jordan, so I appreciate what you're trying to do, but it might not be a cold open sketch. It might be like a first after the monologue sketch. I'm just saying. I really feel like they screw up a joke, and I think that Aaron Sorkin is really good at jokes. like scripted jokes, not the jokes that he's going to end up writing for the show within a show, but you know, they meet up with Cal. That's
Cal. Yeah.
They meet up with Cal. Like, Cal, you left him on for 53 seconds. He's like, yeah, I know. You guys do what you got to do. He's like, well, we need you. So, you know, you're still our director. And he's like, oh, yeah, thank you. And then Matthew Perry's like,
yeah,
I think Matthew Perry, I can't remember if Bradley or Matthew, like, if you left him on for 54 seconds, I'd have given you a raise. That's almost a joke. I think it's 60. Like, one more second wasn't worth the raise. I think it's like, if you gave him a full minute, I'd give you the raise. I get what they're going for. Their point is like,
right,
I'm proud of you for not cutting. You could have gone even longer. But I thought that 54 seconds, when he left him on for 53 seconds, I thought that wasn't quite the joke. That was my take. Maybe I'm overthinking it. Yeah, I guess that's the point of the podcast.
Well, yeah, that's why we're here. That's what it's
overthinking it with Brian and Lex.
Hey, you can write a theme song about this. I quite loved that whole interaction with Cal. The whole him, he waited around for everything else to die down because he's like, okay, eventually they're going to come in here and they're going to fire me. But he just waited around to take it. So like, that just shows some honor, I suppose, or like that he's just being a true human being about this. Yeah. And I really like that. When they chatted as friends. Like, so clearly they knew Cal from way back. Also great. When they said, we need you to stay. Oh, I got goosebumps. I don't know. Something about it just made me so happy.
I love that.
And then my instant thought when they said, if you waited a couple more seconds, would have given you a raise. I was like, that's when he was about to say, drop the F-bomb. Like, that would not have been good for anybody. So I don't know. My instant thought was like, that would have been a really terrible choice for everybody. So I'm glad he didn't do it.
And then you get a moment that, the one that I don't think I got any goosebumps in this episode, but you know, where I had feels, this one I had feels, although I still thought it was, again, a little bit too on the nose right at the end. Bradley Whitford says to Matthew Perry, we live here now. And
oh yeah,
I was like, that's definitely how Sorkin thinks about TV shows. That's probably how SNL folks feel about that show. And I liked it. And then my final note here was, man, I want to watch the next episode. I didn't. But I wanted to.
You have shown that restraint every time, Lex, and I admire you.
It's hard. It's hard. I, honestly, the way I do it is by fearing my own inadequacy and inability to distinguish between the episodes. So if I watch too many, I get confused.
Mm-hmm.
You know how it is.
I do. I do. And I probably would do the same. So I did not watch the next one also. So I guess we'll be going in fresh. And the next episode, what's it called?
Pilot plus one.
Okay. Pilot part two. Pilot. Pilot the cold two. Open.
Hey, so we're just going through the show so far.
I don't know. The last one is end credits.
I really, that was good. I really like when a TV show out the gate feels like it's been around for a while. And I think you and I talked about this in the context of The Newsroom too. And I think that West Wing obviously did this well. But I feel like of all shows, speaking of SNL, the cop show with Andy Samberg, Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine, from the very first episode, is so deep in its own world, and the characters already have incredible rapport. Another one is the Kristen Bell, Ted Danson show. The Bad Place.
The Good
Bad
Place. Place.
The Good Place.
The Good Place.
One of them. I can't remember. Place. I'm old. But like, that's another one. It just feels like so, it knows itself so well. And this one, like, this, Jordan's portrayed confidence as the character feels like Sorkin's actual confidence writing this episode. It felt so strong to me. I was really impressed.
Yeah. But she did it without like being like a superhero who knows everything about audiences and stuff. Like, she still had some vulnerability. You still kind of wonder a little bit, like, is she faking it a little bit until she makes it? Like, and that's cool too. Like, if that's how she's rolling, I'm super there for it.
And
this is one thing that people love about Star Wars. I know you're a big Star Wars fan, Lex. So this is one of the things people really enjoy about it is that world is so lived in. Like, all the X-Wing fighters, the Millennium Falcon and stuff, they're all like barely being held together. Everything's dirty. And that history, that lore and everything just feels, everybody's kind of comfortable in it. And I feel that here too.
Yeah. And I don't know. It really, you're right. It feels lived in and worn, and like that we're peeking in at an exciting time, but that there's been plenty of history. Like, I don't know. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, it's fun to see some of these cast members, or these actors. And like, even the folks who I don't know from a ton of other things or who I haven't seen on a lot of TV shows. Like, there's a lot of really strong stuff happening here. I really, mm-hmm. I liked it. And again, it's the set feels sprawling, the cast feels sprawling, and like the pilot does a lot. You meet a lot of characters and get a lot of storylines going. And I mean, this is why he is who he is. Right? Mm-hmm. This is why he makes the shows and we make podcasts about him. Like, this, I was really impressed.
Hopefully it lives up to it, you know.
It can basically only go downhill from here.
It's true. Good. But I think we're gonna have some winners throughout the rest.
Agreed.
And I don't think we're gonna fall victim to some of the things that the newsroom did. You know, there was like some self-importance that kind of brought it down a bit.
Yes.
There were people just totally acting like idiots, which may still happen here. There's going to be a few relationship-y kind of things that may or may not get under our skin. But I doubt anybody's going to hand someone a flash drive and say, like, the CIA secrets are on here and now you have to go report them on the set of Studio 60. So hopefully we won't end up with any of that.
Yeah, if somebody gets sent out of the country for a couple months, I'm going to be really annoyed on this show. But I'm excited. I'm excited to watch The Cold Open. And even though she tells them to open with it next week, I'm pretty confident that this is the episode I referenced in the trailer, our trailer for this, where Matt's going to spend the whole episode stressing about what the opening should be. And then he does a very unfunny to me parody of Modern Major General in my recollection, which is not Crazy Christians. So I'm just putting that out there. We'll see.
Oh, well, folks, in the meantime, I want you all to watch The Cold Open that's your homework this next week. It'll be Lex and mine as well. We also appreciate if you all go over to theincomparable.com/members, become a member, and send a little bit of scratch our way. We really appreciate that. Lots of good stuff on there. But yeah, hit us up on social or anything and leave us a review too. We really appreciate it.
But thanks for listening. And listen, we do need you to watch the second episode of Studio 60, but we also need you to keep Sorkin in it.
Yes.
Dun, 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 dun.